Welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which is on a mission to make America think again. It's a new year and a new day, and we're going to try to bring some information forward this year, which is an important election year, so that everybody can make the best decisions, because my feeling is we haven't been making the best decisions lately. And to start, we're going to start a series of shows with all the candidates that are running for office in D.C. that actually want to be on the show. So we're going to start the first one today with Dr. Oye Oluwalawa, who is going to run for city council at large. He should be on any minute, and would he say that he called in? Huh. All right. Well, let's see what happens. Let's call him again. But anyway, welcome, Liberty Jones. We've both been on vacation. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling delightful. So excited to be here today. Happy New Year. You know, Happy still in New the spirits Year. Of January. Lots of beautiful things to achieve this year. I'm really excited for this race right now going on in DC politics. Really some beautiful candidates for mayor. And
well, you know what? You got to talk to me about the mayoral candidates, because there's 11 of them, and I looked at their names and I don't recognize any of them. I mean, there may be other people running that haven't registered yet, but of the ones that have registered, I'm like, who are these people?
Yeah, I don't really know any of them either. But I do know that Michael Murphy is a very common person, Marcus Batchelor, and
Marcus is actually running for against Senator Strauss. Yes. Dr. Oluwalawai, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you know, Liberty and I were just talking about the fact that there are 11 candidates for mayor already, and I don't know any of them. Are there any real candidates for mayor out there yet?
I mean, we have two council members that's running. We have definitely a plethora of people that's about to jump in. You know, there hasn't been a mayor opening, I believe, in the last couple of decades. So there's a lot of interest with rain toys going around.
Right.
There's going to be a lot of people getting out there. I know
right.
This gentleman named Gary Goodwood that's out there. Some other folks who may not have as big of a name as you'd expect, but that's why we have elections, right? So people can get themselves out there and go from there and let the people decide.
Right. And let's not forget that Muriel Bowser was a one-term council member before she ran for mayor. So, anything can happen. Nobody's running against you, though, that I see. Is that because you're such an awesome candidate that you've scared all the competition away?
I hope so. No, that's what we're trying to do. Keep them focused on other races. I know that, you know, with Congresswoman Norton now, you know, galvanizing other opponents in her race, whether it's two other council members or even her own staffer, Trent Holbrook, you know, running against her. I know there's a lot of energy in different spaces. Yeah. And at the time where I'm trying to run for council, it seems as if all the other council members are trying to leave. So it's kind of the case of the burning house. Who wants to run into it?
Well, you know, and before I let well, I'm sure Liberty has a lot of questions for you, but before I let her ask you, let me say that, yes, that's an amazing thing, right? Kenya McDuffie is stepping down. Anita Bonds is stepping down. Either Robert White or Brooke Pinto is going to step down because they're going to get another office. Trahan's not stepping down, but we have a good idea that he's not going to be around. So that's four new people right there. And then you've got Fruman and Felder, who are both pretty new. Felder just got elected. Lovely guy. And I've known Matt Fruman for 20 years. Another good guy. But dramatic change on the council, huh?
Absolutely. And Brianna Doe is also retiring, too. So that's one more person
he is.
Who's who's considering leaving the council. So yeah, I even told Wendell the other day, be prepared to be the most senior council member when it's all said and done,
Yeah.
for a freshman to the oldest tenure. So
Isn't that
it's a lot of
crazy?
turnover.
And is everybody leaving because they assume Donald Trump is about to pronounce himself? What about that? What if, because he can't run for re-election, he runs for mayor of Washington, D.C.?
Well, it definitely feels like he's very fascinated and obsessed with us. I mean, you're talking
Yeah, it
about
does.
forcing the mayor to rip up Black Lives Matter Plaza, seeing Congress
Yeah.
freeze our money with no impunity, the federal invasion of agents, whether it's ICE, whether it's National Guard. He just seems dead pressed focused on us. So if he wants to manage DC, then he should probably resign from president for DC mayor. But I don't think it'll work out for him too well. And we need more elected
Well,
officials standing up to him. And that's kind of the reason why, one of the reasons why I'm running as well.
then what does that mean? J.D. Vance becomes chairman of the council. They made me take down my sign. Boy, I had that sign in front of my yard for all those names. The nasty Trump people made me take it down. Go ahead, Liberty, you're on.
I know we need to create a petition and bring it back.
Yeah, I'm gone. I don't live there anymore. I live on an island in the Chesapeake Bay. I abandoned you too. We all left. You're the
I
only
heard.
one.
Well,
You and
maybe it's time not
Liberty
to
are the
name
only
that.
two left in DC. Go ahead, Liberty.
So this is such an exciting time. There's a lot of movement around in DC. My first question to you is, what are you most excited for in this process? What do you hope to bring in terms of change with all of this fluid moment?
I am so glad you asked that. And we've been knocking on doors, been calling people, as you can imagine, being that we launched this campaign in September. And we have a really ambitious vision, whether it's making our public university UDC tuition free or even bringing jobs back to the district to rehire federal workers. But the number one thing I'm hearing from people, whether they agree with this set of politics or another set of politics, is the need for our elected officials to stand up to the Trump administration. I mean, you're seeing the Free DCs, the Harriet's Wildest Dreams, the Flares and other organizations and beyond, even Refuse Fascism, just march regularly, demonstrate regularly. And there seldom is any elected officials that ever show up, let alone speak. So people are looking for that backbone. People are looking for that fighter. And whether it's my years as representative or even some of the demonstrations I've been involved with now, we've been really showing that grit in our candidacy, and people are really responding well to that.
Well, and let me just say, as somebody that's known you for a long time and who's actually worked with you, you've always been a stand-up guy. You've always been somebody that showed up. And I really do think that's so important. So what do you think about statehood? What are we going to do about statehood? Let's start there, since we all worked on it. Well, how about paying a delegation? How about funding a delegation? You've been a member of the delegation. You've seen how our hands were tied. What do you think about those ideas? Will you push an agenda that, yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely. First of all, I want to thank you, Senator Brown, for the leadership and guidance. I mean, I could have made it without you. It would have
Wow.
been plenty of nights where I was
Nice.
crying on your shoulder over this problem or that issue. And, when you talk about investing in paying the Senate senators and the representatives, it's critical not only to professionalize the work that we're doing, but also to recruit candidates who want to take this on that could afford to do so without taking a setback in their careers. I mean, you're looking at a state board of education where each member gets $20,000 a year, and the president of the state board, who's currently John Patterson, gets $21,000 a year. And seeing our fight for DC statehood, seeing the energy that's really being shown on the streets right now, it shows why the roles that you had for so many years was so important, so critical. And had we had that increased investment, whether it's higher amounts of money for the commission and or true salaries, if not stipends, for the office holders, I think it would not only provide more value for the role, but also will give it the weight that it deserves. I mean, we go to other states, I mean, Senator Brown, you mentioned this, how you go to other states and you're treated sometimes with more respect over there than you do here in DC.
It's
And when
true.
we're talking about statehood and how to make sure we keep this fight going, it comes with empowering the people who are in office to do just that.
And you know what I think? One of the reasons I don't like our Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Robert Kennedy, is because nobody in his family likes him. If nobody in your family likes you, what does that say about you? You know, and that's the problem with the people in D.C. if they don't support the delegation. And you know that's true, and I'm sure you will fight for it. And that's an important thing. You know, the people that had these offices previously in Alaska, they got paid the equivalent of $75,000. And you know, it's a matter of credibility as well as anything else. It's really not a matter of money. And it's funny, it's ironic. The rumor is they don't want to pay us. They don't want to pay people that have these offices because they don't want the competition. But you know what? We all run for other offices. I ran for city council. You're running for city council. Paul ran for city council.
Right.
A Capozzi ran for city council. Nate Bennett Fleming ran for city council. Everybody does. Why? Because they make the jobs that we get elected to so impotent instead of important. Liberty, go. I've got my angst out. Go ahead.
So, I have a creative question for you. At the end of the day, I'm a college student, so this is how we think. If DC were to become a state tomorrow, what would you want to do with that?
I am so glad you asked that question. You know, when I first ran for this role as the U.S. representative about 4 and some change years ago, actually probably like 5 years because it was during the pandemic, a lot of the conversations began and ended with congressional voting representation, which is critical because it allows us to use our votes to get more appropriation, allows us to have a say on judges and things like that that currently evade us. But there's so many other things in DC that's impacted by not being a state. Number one, we have a federal justice system. A lot of our imprisoned Washingtonians are sent to other states far away from their families, far away from any social structure that they need to re-enter society. Our laws are compromised. We're not able to pass legislation without, federal oak thumbs up, basically. And that impacts how we pass laws. Our budget was frozen last year because we were treated as a federal agency, not as a state, so forth and so forth. Now, if DC were to become a state, I could wave my magic wand. I would love to just pass all the progressive legislation and laws that people in the council right now are afraid to pass. Things like banning fur sales, things like banning foie gras, which is one of the most cruelty-made dishes where they fatten up animals and eat their livers. Like, these are things that we can do immediately, and we can actually start to do things free of the federal and congressional oppression that we currently have. Last but not least, we can start putting down, replacing Black Lives Matter applause and all these things without threat of removing our infrastructure funding. Just being able to breathe fresh air and be treated as first-class citizens that we deserve to be.
Absolutely.
That's absolutely true. Well, let me ask you about as long as we're talking about careers, let's talk about you for a second. You have a professional career. You're a pharmacist, a doctor, a pharmacy. What happens to your pharmaceutical career? Do you put that on hold, or do you continue to do both jobs?
Heck no, I'm not putting it down. I still pay licensing. This is damn expensive in DC. I'm gonna work once a week. I'll make it worth it. I'll pay it back. So, yeah, I'll continue working once in a while or so. Obviously, with the council position that pays, I'll be able to work at the pharmacy less. But no, we're gonna continue using that thing.
And you're allowed to do that in DC. So, plenty of people have been college professors, for example. And what do you think about you have any feeling about the Norton race? Do you think the more people that get in there, there's the rumor that and I think it's pretty solid that she's not going to run for re-election.
I think that right now we have a really stacked lineup. I mean, like I said before, we have two council members who are established running for that position. We have State Board of Education President Jock Patterson running for it. We have Michelle Williams, former ANC, who ran for that seat a few times, running for it. So I believe that Congresswoman Norton probably has the stiffest competition that she's ever had. I know Donna Brazile wrote a op-ed basically requesting that she doesn't run again. And I believe she has a difficult question about her future lying ahead. We just saw Steny Hoyer announce his retirement. And right now we're seeing a lot of voters want that new age of leadership. And they're not wrong. And I think with the current Trump dynamic in D.C., we need new leaders. We need bold vision. And the answer of tomorrow can't just be renewing what worked in the past. I don't think that's a winning message, and I don't think that's the right direction. I think we need new, progressive, bold leadership.
Well, I'm all for old guys retiring from politics. Liberty Jones, go ahead.
You know, so am I. I'm hoping to be in the race pretty soon myself, actually. And let's talk a little more about statehood. You know, statehood is essential, but obviously Senator Brown and you as well have taught me that it is not immediate. So how do you think that DC should balance, you know, fighting for full sovereignty with aggressively using the power it already has, but also being able to get things done, you know, with the power it has?
No, absolutely. I, you know, as you can imagine, right now compared to 2 years ago, it seems like a step back, right? We don't have Republican. We have Republican control of the Congress, Senate. We have crazy maniac Donald Trump in the White House, and the Supreme Court is just backing up all of his actions. But Senator Brown could also tell you, it's not just those on paper that oppose us. It's also the people on paper that are supposed to support us that just not championing us enough. And right now, we have an opportunity of really galvanizing that energy and seeing who's really with us, especially in the Democratic Party. And if they're not really with us, we need to find their replacements. And just getting ourselves ready for this conversation, I'm concerned that once Trump leaves, I mean, one day with a 28 or whatever, that oftentimes that activism ends with that. We need to keep that energy going. And if we have a plan of harvesting this energy, you know, the spotlight that we're having, making sure the nation is paying attention to local D.C., not just federal D.C., then we can actually help the stars align and maybe push statehood to be a day one issue. Barack Obama in 2008 had the stars aligned. He had a supermajority in the Senate. He had a majority in the House. If he wanted D.C. to become a state, it could have become a state, but it wasn't a priority. Hopefully next time that happens, will be a priority when we get over the finish line. So yes, we are taking a step back with Trump in office, but with so much activism. I mean, I feel like there's a protest every other day in D.C. for one reason or another. If we can keep that energy and harness it for the fight for D.C. statehood, then I think we can actually propel us forward when all things align.
Yeah, you know, I never quite understood why the Democrats spent $40 million in Georgia to get a Democrat elected, Warnock elected, but they won't spend the money and effort in D.C. You spend $40 million in D.C. to become a state, and when they become a state, you get two Democrats. You get double your money. So I never understood why there wasn't more of why the Democrats don't support us as fiercely as the Republicans oppose us, because they oppose us constantly, right? Even Leavitt, and when they were talking about getting rid of the filibuster, what's the first thing they said? Oh, they'll make D.C. a state. They'll make Puerto Rico a state. They'll make D.C. a state. So these guys are afraid of D.C., and I don't know why we don't support it more. Let me ask you, assaults in the District of Columbia are down since the beginning of the year. Just about every crime is down, but violent crime is up 10%, and assaults with a dangerous weapon are up 109%. What's going on lately? You think this has? Do you have any sense of this? Is this something that has to do with ICE being in town and? Or is this just the normal flow of things?
Well, I definitely believe that Trump is having a negative presence in DC, and he's not helping us public in our public safety sector. You know, having ICE agents wearing masks, unmarked cars, jumping up on top of people based off of the way they look, or grab people off the scooters based off of how way they look, is inspiring a lot of fear and distrust with law enforcement. Having a National Guard have a presence in DC when they have no training in cultural competency and they're not even from the DC area does not make our community safer. What makes our community safer is true investment. Getting kids into college makes our community safer. Every year, someone goes through university decreases their risk of committing violent offense by 10%. 1 year is 10%, 2 years is 20%, and beyond and beyond and beyond. Now, it doesn't change their risk of committing like financial crimes, but when people are concerned about public safety, they're concerned about the burglaries, the assault with deadly weapons, the robberies, domestic abuses, those types of things. And getting more young people to go to college, getting people's literacy rates up really improve that. Getting people into careers rather than suffering from unemployment takes away their propensity of committing acts of violence. And that's something that the president is not paying attention to. He's fired federal workers. 10,000, 20,000, 40,000 DC residents are without jobs. That's not making our community safer. And if Donald Trump really wants to make DC safe, he could stop wasting money on the National Guard and just rehire the federal workers and really reduce unemployment. I've never seen a president excited to lay people off. Like, this is not leadership. And what I'm looking to do as council, hopefully, is to help bring careers to DC to help fill those gaps that this president created.
Well, given that, and given that the new buzzword for the Democratic Party is affordability, what do we need to do to make DC more affordable? I want to tell you that I paid $400,000 for my house and I just sold it for close to 1.5 million. I don't
Oh,
know who can
congrats.
afford to, I don't know who can afford a house for $1.5 million. That you, how young people could do that. How my friend Liberty Jones is ever going to move out of the dormitory. Even after she's out of college, she'll probably have to live there for a while, right? So how does Liberty go and spend? She loves DC, so how does she spend the rest of for a long period of time there and have a career there and be able to afford to live there?
Well, I live in Ward 8. Come down this way, Liberty. But more importantly and realistically, there's a couple of things we need to do. Number one, we need to get people to know what they qualify for. I remember about 8 years ago when I decided I wanted to buy a house in DC. I went to every housing seminar, every program, and they told me either I made too much for this or I didn't have enough children to get that. And then I just bit the bullet one day. Pay 3% for a house, pay skyrocketed mortgage and interest rates. But I just figured it out. And after I bought the house, I learned I could have qualified for this, I could have qualified for that. And I recognized my privilege as a pharmacist. But then I realized, what happened if I wasn't a pharmacist? And that's when I realized all these people moving to Maryland, all these people moving to Virginia because they don't know what they have access to. Now, DC is very resource rich. Communication poor. So the first thing I would do is make sure that people know what they qualify for. And then number two, I'm not sure if this would fully apply for Liberty, but I would want to really improve the outcomes for young people who live in traditionally generational homes, right? I've been volunteering in DC classrooms for the past 12 years, getting kids interested in science careers. And I know what having a scientist in the family does. It increases the economy of that family, that community, that neighborhood. And if a grandmother has a grandchild who's now a pharmacist, now it might be easier for them to maintain that house once the grandparent passes. You don't have to worry about the property tax being so high they have to sell it. You don't have to worry about gentrification happening because the community just can no longer afford the upkeep of that neighborhood. And we will be able to suppress. Hopefully suppress the home market of home costs because we're not worrying about all these LLCs and private organization equity groups buying up houses and selling them for the premier price. So really trying to navigate how we can keep housing within our communities, not just people who've been long-term DC residents, but also people like Liberty who can buy a house from somebody else, not from a private equity group rated price gouger out of the district, and really find ways to connect people with resources, which is APAP or whatever, that can actually keep them in DC and not force them to move out because nobody knows what's available.
And what scares you the most, Liberty, as a college student? You're about to get out of college and go out into that brave new world of looking for a job and finding a career and doing all that scary stuff. What is it that troubles you most?
You know, I think very related to this conversation, every time I'm asked this question, I think of it differently. And today, my mind really goes to, you know, the fact that DC is predominantly a Black city governed by Black leadership, right? If we hope to do it right. And I think that really affects the way that Congress treats DC. And so a big concern for me is that, and I think for a lot of people, is that these, even the information and how it is being dispersed is really, you know, unequally affecting the people who need it the most. And I mean, I don't really know. I think you guys know a lot better, you know, given DC's history of, you know, redlining and displacement, how should we understand all of this, like, federal interference in DC housing and in DC politics overall through a racial lens?
Well, you know, beyond that though, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but beyond that, what scares you? Do you think, when I got out of college, Liberty, I assumed that I would have a good job. I assumed that I would have a house, that there'd be no problem, and I'd have a family if I wanted it, all these things. Do you make those assumptions?
You know, I do not make those assumptions. I have a lot of fear. I am a first generation American, so unfortunately, I wish grandma's house would be somewhere for me to sit back on. I don't have that. I am worried, but it worries me even more when I feel like the people who and institutions who are there to help me are leading their own agendas that are not doing what they're supposed to. And so that's why I think DC government is so special, because they really do have a connection to the people. And I think that this is a problem we see every day, is especially, you know, now in Trump's times, it's beautiful to see the streets so active with activism, because I think that really is how to make the world move, you know, be the change you want to see in the world, help make the difference that needs to happen. And that is my fear, that unfortunately that we will put up a fight, but that there will always be barriers. And as a young person, you know, people like you really inspire me, because that's something I'm learning to navigate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I wanted to add to that. The biggest concern I have is lessening of the quality of life for the younger generation. You know, typically, whether we're grandparents, whether we're parents, our goal is that our children would have better lives, or at least opportunities to live better than we have. And we're seeing the exact opposite. Well, my parents came to this country, my dad in particular. I mean, my mom and dad kind of came at the same time in the 1970s. The median income of the middle class was $50,000. Today, that's the buying power of $420,000. And the federal poverty range was $18,000. Today, that's $150,000. So if somebody is making $75,000 a year, $80,000 a year, and they're single, and they feel like they're falling behind and they don't know where the money is going, they're not crazy, because the cost of everything has gone up while wages have gone stagnant. And while wages have gone stagnant, productivity has gone higher. And that's why we're seeing people about to approach trillionaire status, not even billion, trillionaire status, because the money is going to the top, and we'd rather have political conversations about immigration and not those billionaires becoming trillionaires. And my concern is that the conversation is typically punching down on immigrants, punching down on the LGBTQ plus community, especially the trans community, punching down on folks who are trying to squeeze two nickels together rather than focusing up where a lot of the money is being concentrated. And we're seeing consequences of that. I mean, D.C., for the first time in a long time, is seeing a birth deficit. Like, there's fewer babies being born in D.C. And you're looking at career professionals who can't afford to have families, can't afford to live on their own, can't afford to buy a house, even with a spouse. And the lessening quality of life for the younger generation, I believe, is the reason why we're seeing so many what they would usually call left wing or right wing or extreme candidates win, because the status quo is not working. And I don't think people are ready to accept the go along, get along status quo candidates anymore. And we just need to have that conversation, whether it's progressive taxing, whether it's redistribution of wealth, or even just making sure that people are getting paid their fair due. It's something that I've been paying attention to, because there's no way we're going to be able to improve the quality of lives of young people or even have nuanced conversations about climate change until we're fixing the wage issue. If people were getting paid $420,000 a year, then maybe the rent issue wouldn't be so drastic, or home buying wouldn't be so unattainable, because people are being paid compared to what they should have been paid in the 1970s compared to now.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, I told you about my house, but the first house I moved into in Rockville, Maryland, back in the 1960s with my parents, cost $17,000 new. And it was a nice house. It was a four-bedroom house. So I worry about that a lot, too, that the affordability for my children will not be there. My oldest daughter just bought her first house. But I worry that all the opportunities that we had, and we had a lot of opportunities, you know, like I say, I never thought twice that I would have a good job or be able to afford a house or, whatever. And I see those just disappearing all over the place. What's your next? Oh, let's talk about this. This could take up some time. Ranked choice voting. What a silly idea ranked choice voting is. Do you like ranked choice voting?
Like this, Senator Brown. Currently in D.C., we were winning, candidates were winning with plurality of the vote. So all you needed was plus one compared to the next person. And we were seeing council candidates winning with 28%, 25%, even last time on Ward 7, 22 point something percent. And they weren't getting the majority of voters. Now, in other states, whether they're blue or red, Republican or Democrat, Georgia, Texas, Illinois, they had runoffs. It is simple. If you didn't get 50%, you went to a runoff and someone got 50%. Now, ranked choice voting is an instant runoff, right? And the solution was basically to give an opportunity for someone to get more than 50% of the vote. And I supported it because the alternative was status quo, and I just didn't believe in status quo. Typically in ranked choice voting, the person who wins the first round wins it all together, but just knowing that you can have confidence that whoever wins this race gets the majority of the votes, I think is important to me.
Well, I would just say, and I challenge you to answer this question, is that since the beginning of home rule, nobody who's ever run for your office in the second position has ever gotten 50% of the vote. That never happened. So there's going to be a runoff election in your election, is there not? And if history follows suit, and given that, does that change your strategy, the way you run? Does that change anything about the way you want to run your campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you're doing ranked choice voting, what this means is that each voter will rank who their favorite is, second favorite is, third favorite is. And after certain rounds, the last person that race will be removed and their votes will be redistributed until someone gets 50% or higher. It definitely changes, because now you have to run a less negative campaign. You know, it's as much as you want to be liked, you can't be disliked because someone will not rank you and you will be extremely, extremely vulnerable to that ranking apparatus, so to speak. So you definitely have to run a bigger tent campaign. You can't just find your 35% of the vote and go home. You have to make sure everybody at least respects you and likes you enough to rank you. So it does change the way you talk to voters. It definitely changes the way how you interact with your fellow candidates, because we saw in New York how Zohran Mamdani was able to galvanize the Michael Blakes, the Landers, and other candidates to kind of form a wall against Andrew Cuomo. So, you know, you definitely want to make sure you're on your P's and Q's, your smile is brightest, and you're not talking trash about other people and really focusing on, you know, the credibility of your campaign and the value of your vision.
Well, even more technical question, how does it work with you when the first two vote getters are the winners? Does it go one, two, three, and four? If nobody gets 50%, I mean, if there's a top vote getter that gets more than 50%, then they're in. But in the second place, there's almost got to, I can't believe the one.
Oh, I think you're referring to the general election rather than a primary.
Yes, the general, not the primary.
Yeah. Got it.
And you know what? And then let me ask you something. If Dr. Oluwalawa gets 49% of the vote, but I get 52% of the second vote, and I get elected, aren't I the lesser candidate? I got less of the vote. That's another problem I have with ranked choice voting. I think it's going to be a mess for DC. That's my personal prediction. But but I understand the philosophy behind it. Liberty, don't let me monopolize the show. Ask a question.
No, please. I'm very intrigued by this ranked choice situation. you know, these are just, this is one example of how things would be different if the people really did have the power that they were promised. You know. but yeah, do you guys think that DC is an example in America today that democracy works better the closer it is to the people and worse the farther that it is from them?
Absolutely. We are an example of second-class citizens that's trying to do the best we can while operating under federal oppression and intervention and sabotage at times. You know, we're seeing our own laws being ripped away from us by Congress. We had a revised criminal code that was stripped away or allowed to be overturned. This is during the Biden administration. It wasn't even during the Trump administration. We've seen some of our friends in the Congress walk back on us and okay that change. And I remember Senator Brown was very vocal against, you know, some of the ways we may have provoked some of our federal partners to go against us. I believe that we make the best decisions for ourselves. We elect our mayor, we elect our council, we elect our attorney general, who's right now battling for his seat because there's a bill in Congress to literally strip him from his job and replace him with the presidential appointed attorney general, just like our U.S. attorney. And what we've seen is our attorney general go after businesses for unfair labor practices, go after slumlords for unfair housing conditions, and really be that vessel of defense when the council can't pull it off. And it shows what happens when we're able to have our own take care of us. And compared to other states, compared to other jurisdictions, D.C. is forced to send council a balanced budget, meaning that whatever we raise is what we can spend. And what we get from the federal government, we got to spend wisely and judiciously. Not other areas have that. And it shows what we can do, even with the hand tied behind our back, and we're very proud of the work and progress we've been able to do. We just want to be able to do what we want without President Trump getting in the way, without Congress getting in the way, without the Senate freezing our money and making us have to work with far less than we deserve, so we can actually pay our teachers, pay our firefighters, pay our law enforcement what they deserve, and not have ICE and the National Guard on our streets where they don't belong or they're not trained to provide protection. So we just need them out of our way, and hopefully with your platform, we have a bigger spotlight on neighborhood DC and not just Congress and the White House, where typically gets all the spotlight from the national press.
Well, that's our Achilles heel too, isn't it? That, you know, you want to change the gun laws in Washington, D.C., because then if you're running for Congress in Texas, where, you know, anybody above the age of six can have a semi-automatic weapon, you can't change it. There's no gun laws to change, but you change them in Washington, you get national press from it. So that always gets us. And, you know, our whole system of government is based on the fact that you are the best steward of your own self-interest, right? That's why we have freedom in our democracy, is that you are always the best steward of your own self-interest. I just say everything I ever learned about politics, I learned from a popular song, and Cole Porter said, you know, God bless the child that's got his own. So I'm sorry, that was the Gershwin brothers that said, God bless the child that's got his own. And I believe that. I believe that you're best to be in control of your own fate. Let's talk about ICE for a minute. It seems to me that what's going on in Milwaukee and in Minnesota and in other places right now, that DC is just ripe for that kind of activity, right? And maybe you can chime in on this too, Liberty, since you're in college, and I know that ICE has been on your campus. How's it going right now with ICE? Do you know? Are we in better shape than we were a few months ago when they seemed to be cracking down on everybody picking up people at Home Depots and stuff? Hello?
I thought that was for Oye.
No, is it? Yeah, it's for Oye. Are you there?
I'm still here. I thought you were talking to Liberty.
No, I was saying both of you. You know, I don't know how she feels about it, but what is your feeling? Are you feeling that we're better off than we were a few months ago when it seemed like ICE was everywhere? And
what I'll say is this about Donald Trump. It seems as if all of his crazy ideas start with D.C. We're like the ground zero of all his bad ideas, the training wheels. So whether it's threatening elected officials or candidates with withholding funding if we don't do what he wants, basically what happened in D.C., whether it's sticking National Guard against us in D.C., they turn around, try to do it in L.A. and in New York City, and they said what's going to happen, they turn back. When it's now ICE, it seems as if he tried it here first, and because we're so vulnerable as a non-state, we had to just kind of go along with it and figure out what the relationship would be like, gave him the ammunition, the energy to take it to other areas. Now it's in Minnesota. And to see the murder of Renee Nicole Good and what happened over there, not only does it concern me about the strained relationship between this community and law enforcement, basically their job is to serve and protect us, but it also goes a step farther on what could have happened here in D.C. Because when the National Guard was first deployed in the district, they weren't armed. But about a couple of weeks later, Trump decided to have them armed. And me living in Southeast Washington, D.C., Ward 8, I'm extremely concerned with National Guards members with AK-47s, with pistols and guns, walking up and down Good Hope Road, now Marion Barry Avenue, looking at young kids with logs, thinking that they're really 20, but they might be just 15, and not having a positive interaction. And next thing you know, someone gets shot. That's what concerns me, because not everyone's going to have the presence of mind to have a phone out. Not everybody's going to be able to say, this person did nothing wrong. And I'm very, very concerned with, like I said before, people who are not trained. Donald Trump is basically providing people $35,000 to join ICE. If anybody's joining at this point, and they're now having guns down these streets. They have no idea how to de-escalate situations. They're shooting at people driving away from them, and they're jumping out of unmarked vehicles with masks on. This is not keeping our community safe at all. And my concern with Donald Trump is, although ICE has a less of a presence here than they had a few months ago, anytime Trump has a stupid idea, it starts off with DC first. And we're not off the hook because he's going to be president for the next 3 years. So I'm looking for all elected officials to continue speaking out against this. Stop being afraid of joining people in the streets marching against this. Because whenever Donald Trump has an idea, it starts here in the nation's capital. And if we don't fight for ourselves over here, then the people in Minnesota, Texas, Virginia, California won't know how to fight with us.
Well, and you know what? That really speaks volumes to your earlier point of how we all really have a vested interest in this, because I think Donald Trump likes to use us as a whipping boy because it feeds his base, who doesn't like the District of Columbia. You know, unfortunately, in my travels around the country, I found that many people see the District of Columbia as, you know, we all work for the IRS. You know, we're not teachers and doctors and lawyers and mothers and fathers. And, you know, we're all government workers that are out to make their lives harder and more expensive somehow. So he's, you know, I think his base feels that way. They dislike the district. So it's easy for him to pick on the district. I don't know. But we're running out of time here. So let me ask you, what are your top three priorities, Doc?
Yeah, so running for council, you know, we really tried to build or rebuild the middle class, you know, working class that was been left behind by the recent budget. One thing we're trying to do is make UDC tuition free, so young people will be able
Great
to
idea.
Get a college education and not be stuck with $10,000, $20,000, $40,000, $50,000 in student debt. Number two, as you said before, I'm a pharmacist. I want to stabilize the healthcare system so we can save costs without kicking people off of their insurance. And last but not least, we're trying to work to bring different careers, international development careers to D.C. to rehire the federal workers that were laid off by Trump. You know, the mayor signed off on a huge stadium deal for the Commanders, and I don't think that's enough to rebuild our economy. I think we need to rehire folks at a high pay scale to make sure that D.C. residents can afford to stay in D.C. and make sure those wages are higher up so young people and people reentering the workforce have a standard of quality of life that can keep them comfortable and live with dignity in the district. Those are the three things that we're fighting for. Of course, we also have to stand for Donald Trump as well. None of this happens if we keep acquiescing to their agenda and being afraid to speak truth to power. So we have to also maintain that rigor, maintain that fight that we've been doing for the past 4 or 5 years as the representative, and just keep that mission centered around that. You set the precedence for it. You were never afraid to yell at a council member. You were never afraid to speak truth to the mayor. And we need to keep that vision and keep that fight alive in 2026.
Well, thanks. And on that last thing you said, I think we need to buy a front line before we build a new stadium to keep that quarterback of ours from being killed. But Liberty, let give you the last question.
This has been a beautiful conversation. You know, I feel a lot of confidence with your views in this election. And I guess my last question for you would be, you know, let's bring it home, literally. What is something that you are bringing out there that you think you learned from your family, from your ancestors, that you think is a moral foundation? You know, a big thing about Trump, and Senator Brown said himself, how could you support a man whose family doesn't support him? So for you, what is something you learned from, you know, your grandmother or your ancestors that you think you walk with every day?
Well, it's that self-awareness, right? Like my mom and dad, you know, they've done a lot for me, and we stand on the shoulders of those who fought for this opportunity. Now, there are people who fought for the Civil Rights Act, Black folks, foundationally Black descendants of slavery, who fought for the opportunity for my parents that eventually moved here for college. They guided me to become a pharmacist. And I understand the privileges that allow me to do things that so many folks in D.C., regardless if they look like me or not, or same skin color as me or not, don't have. My goal is to use my privileges to create opportunities for others. I started my public service by getting kids interested in science careers that could become like me, but they shouldn't have to be me to get to where I'm at. you know, using the fight that I learned from Senator Brown and others to create opportunities for folks who are returning citizens, folks who are struggling business owners that don't know about how to get certifications, grants, contracts. Just create opportunities for what I know and what I've been able to learn in a short amount of time to make sure those without a voice get their voice. I want people to see this race as not the seat OEA is running for, but the seat that they believe they can impact and be in, because this is not about someone who could be in office for the next 50 years. This is someone who wants to achieve something on day one and hopefully be there for a couple of years doing some great things. I'm not going to be a career politician. I'm not going to be running for my reelection at age 80. My goal is to get a couple of things done and help inspire the next generation to take this job from me.
Well, that's a great way to end, but I'm sorry. Were you going to say something?
That was very beautifully said. I respect
Well, yeah, and I agree with that. It was very beautifully said. So let's give your website so that people can send you lots of money so you can win. What's your website?
We're doing the public matching program. So if you live in D.C., your donations match times six. Most of you give us $100, that'll be matched to be $600. But if you can give $5, that becomes $30. My website is Vote for OEA. So Vote, V-O-T-E, number four, OEA.com. My social media is Rep OEA DC, REPOYEDC. Now, I would normally say vote for me on June 16th, but with Rank Choice voting, please vote. Rank me number one. No, rank me number five. Rank me number one.
Yes.
On June 16th, primary election for the at-large council.
And for what it's worth, you have my endorsement. I wholeheartedly support your candidacy. I want to see you get elected. And we're going to leave you with the song tonight, which is my favorite campaign song. It was actually written by the candidate, Huey Long. Not the most honest guy, but a colorful politician. It's called Every Man a King. So this is for you, for good luck, because Huey always won. Here's his campaign song, Every Man a King. We'll see you next week. Thank you, Representative Oluwalawa. We look forward to seeing you elected to the city council.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you.